All right, let's get started. Chapter 7. Still, it's a long chapter in my defense. it's a long book. Anyways, so we've got tonight and two other Sundays before the quarter is over. So kind of like last time, let me press on and do as much explaining as I can. If you've got a comment you really feel strongly about, or if you've got a question that's of general applicability, if it's something you've always wondered about personally, maybe you can hold on to that. I'd be happy to talk with you after class or outside of class or during the week if you know where to find me. If it's one of those, you know, I've always wondered about, why a word is spelled a certain way or something like that. I'm not I've offended everybody before we even get started. But chapter 7, let's, actually a very important chapter just because of what it deals with. So, but before we get started, let's do a word of prayer. Can I get a brother to lead us in that? Somebody want to do that?
That was Bob.
Thanks.
Dear merciful Father, we're just so grateful for this chance to have your word open and our hearts are open to receive the truth and make the necessary application. Bless Jeff and his efforts. In Christ's name we pray.
Amen. Amen. All right, for as long as chapter 7 is, Paul envisions a variety of scenarios in which he applies certain basic principles. And so again, because we're so limited on time, really want to hit the basic principles and the verses that hold them in this chapter. And we won't, you know, we won't have time as much to dig into all of the various scenarios he has. Now, chapter 7, he's dealing with questions they've asked and raised, but he set this up because he's already talked about sexual immorality in chapters 5 and 6. So now he comes to the right place for sexuality to be fulfilled, which is a marriage between a man and a woman. But obviously, life's not simple, and there's lots of questions about marriage between a man and a woman, even raises. And so he starts by emphasizing, and we talked about this last time, verses 1 through 5, he starts by emphasizing the fact that there needs to be sexual activity in marriage, that wives don't withhold themselves from husbands, and vice versa. You're sinning against your spouse, basically, doing that. And ironically, verse 5, you don't withhold yourself because you're mad at them. The only real vision that Paul has of withholding yourself sexually is by consent and for spiritual purposes, not to get even or make sure they know how angry you are about something or whatever it is. Serious stuff. Because ultimately, Satan may tempt you for lack of self-control sexually if you are withholding yourself from your spouse. That being said, verses 6 through 9, Paul emphasizes that he actually, and he says this is a concession, this is not a command, he's emphatic about that. But he actually wishes that folks were able to forego marriage, but he recognizes that few can do what he himself has chosen to do. It's a gift from God, it's an ability, it's an opportunity, it's something that not everybody can bear with. But there are reasons for that, and we talked about that, I think, a little bit last time, but in case we didn't, verses 17 or so and following, he unpacks that a little bit more. 17 through, well, really through 31 or so. Kind of stay in the condition you are if possible. But ultimately, it's about whatever allows you to serve the Lord the best. That's especially what he gets at. In these verses. Actually, verses 32 through 35 as well. If you're married, you have to be concerned about how to take care of and please your spouse. If you're unmarried, you can stay focused on the Lord. And in particular, in this large section, 17 through, I guess really 35 we're now saying, part of it is, verse 29 through 31, the appointed time has grown very short. Drop down to verse 31, the present form of this world is passing away. Because Christ has now come, prophecies have been fulfilled, what yet has to be done by God before he can end the world? And the answer is? Nothing. And so now, you know, yes, there was Genesis to be fruitful and multiply, all that, and it's still good. God doesn't deny it, it's still good. But what we now know, but they didn't have, is the fulfillment of Genesis chapter 3 and all the other covenants and promises. We now know that the end is at hand. We know what God's end game is, the kingdom of God. We know about Jesus. And so the whole point is, if you can stay focused on that, without going to sexual sin, Paul says you might think about that. But not everybody has that gift. But again, kind of goes back to what we were talking about this morning. What, how do you make your decisions in life? What's best for
the Lord,
and the kingdom? And we miss that in this passage when we get caught down in all the details. What Paul is fundamentally saying about your decisions about whether to get married or not get married really has to be, how best can I serve the Lord? It's really what he's getting at, bottom line. Now, part of it can be literally avoiding sin. That, and that's legit. He puts it on the table. But part of it can also be, how can, you know, Paul says, this is part of why I made the choice I've made. I know not everybody can do it, but I wanted to be an apostle first. And stay focused on that. So, that being said, that's one thread in this very long passage. Another thread, well, you know, for those who do get married, verse 10, to the married, then what? And there, 10 through 16 is kind of a unit. First of all, verses 10 to 11. And we talked about this a little bit last time, I think, but let's hit this hard because this is another one of those passages that's hard to hear. Okay? And this fundamental, it's very important that we get in our minds and our hearts right now, before we're in marriage crisis, or for some of us before we're even married, let's be very clear about what Paul is saying and what Jesus has said, because this tracks exactly with what Jesus has said, rightly understood. And so verses 10 and 11, and we're going to skip the parentheses parts, because parentheses mean something is, you know, or side to the main point. And so let's just read the main point. Here's the actual sentence. Here's the main point. Because, especially when things are hard to hear, we get distracted by the side issues rather than the main points. And the main point, Paul says, is this. To the married, I give this charge, that the wife should not separate from her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. There it is. To the married, what does Paul say?
Stay that way.
Stay that way. Well, what about XYZ? Paul doesn't go there. What's the bottom line commandment of God? And we will put the first parentheses back in play now. Not I, but the Lord. In other words, this is not just Paul's opinion, which he's given earlier about singleness. This is what the Lord has said. And the Lord in this context would be Jesus. Has Jesus spoken to this? What did Jesus say?
Is God born together, let not man put asunder.
There it is. We always focus on the exceptions. And in the exceptions, we lose sight of the basic principle. If God has put this together, do you have a right to go busting it up? No. And so what happens in the Bible if you do something that God said don't do? Say it louder. Let's all be accountable to each other on this.
It's sin.
It's sin. If you do something the Lord has said not to do, it is sin. And we need to ground ourselves in that, especially before the bad times come, the hard times come, before it's a crisis with one of our children, or somewhere in the extended family. Let's be clear on this. The fundamental statement is, don't divorce. And if you do something that the Lord has said do not do, what have you done? And it was hard to hear back then. It's not just what we know now or life today. What did the disciples say when Jesus taught on this?
It's hard.
In fact, ironically, they started thinking about singleness.
Yeah.
If this is the way it is, it's better for a man not to marry. This is hard to hear. You mean I'm stuck with her? You mean I'm stuck with him? And Jesus says, yes.
The other way around.
We'll offend everybody with this because it's hard to hear. Verse 11 and the second parentheses, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. That's a sidebar. What Paul is simply saying is not. What Paul knows is human nature. He's inspired, and he's also experienced. And so what we often do when we do choose to sin, when we do something we shouldn't have done, is we say, well, you know, okay, I shouldn't have done that. I won't do that again. I won't divorce again. But now that I am divorced, what might I think about doing?
Justifying
it. But marrying the person I should have married the first time. That's what, you know, I mean, okay, I shouldn't have done that. You're right, I'm sorry. I'll go forward. I'll confess to the church, the elders, you know, the God, whoever. I shouldn't have done that sin. But now that I have, well, you know, water under the bridge, such is life, nobody's perfect, everybody makes mistakes, so, you know, put whatever rationalizing phrase you want in there. And Paul says, no. Once you've done this, and you realize you shouldn't have done this, your option is not to seek out a new spouse. What are your only two options, Paul says? Reconcile or stay unmarried. This is not, you know, I shouldn't have done it, but once I did, you know, I shouldn't have stolen the candy bar, but since I've already eaten it, you know, Paul says, don't play that game. What God has joined together, not man put asunder, which means if man puts it asunder, does that necessarily mean God's unjoined it? No. So your only two options, Paul says, if you've disobeyed on this, now what? You got two options, Paul says. Reconcile or stay unmarried. And why does he say stay unmarried? Think about this.
Because you're still married.
Because you're still married. And the problem, unlike a lot of sins, where I may have done something I shouldn't have, and I realize that after the fact, that I want to make it right, I want to repent, I want to make it right, I want to get back on the straight and narrow. You know, I can do that with a lot of things, but the problem with busting up a marriage is it's not solely in my power to fix it once it's broken. Because what do I need, you know, if I want to reconcile, what am I depending on? And he or she might, after I've done this, say,
no way.
No way. And now I might, you know, again, you know, here's Paul, you know, thinking how we think, knowing how we think. Paul's sitting there saying, okay, now you think because I tried to reconcile and he or she said no. Now what do I get to do?
Remarry.
Now I get to remarry. And Paul says, nope. Even if they, you know, who broke it up? You did.
So, Jeff, the way you're reading that, you're also reading that parenthetical impliedly after, and the husband should not divorce his wife.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, you have to pick a gender and roll with it, but no, I mean, I think this is, the principle is the principle.
So divorce is not permanent when you're talking about reconciliation.
No, I mean, I think that's the thing, is you need to get back together. Because remember, what did Paul say at the beginning of the chapter? Part of the marriage is a remedy for sexual sin.
Marriage.
Yeah, and so especially if I have divorced my spouse, leaving them and potentially leaving them no right to remarriage because, you know, if I just decided I wanted out or something, I left. What burden have I put on them? Sexual temptation. They trusted me to provide that sexual outlet to them for their sexual urges, and what have I robbed them of? I've robbed them of that. Yeah, go ahead.
Just real quick. The other part of this problem is, for the person who thinks they can remarry, is they're creating an adulterous relationship the second time.
Oh, it just multiplies, yeah.
So the person who may be going into that relationship thinking it's perfectly okay,
yep.
You're dragging them into a sin that they may not recognize because maybe they don't know God yet, but you're dragging them into a sin that they've now got to deal with.
Oh, absolutely.
That could damage them.
You know, and then God forbid kids are born and just, right. I mean, just the catastrophe, you know, just keeps spiraling. Absolutely. And so what we learn, folks, is that sex and marriage are a really big deal to God and should not be trafficked lightly. We have stupid shows in this culture. I use that word on purpose, like The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, just making a mockery of how serious this is. God forbid. And we need to make sure our young people, those of us who have kids and grandkids, we need to make sure they understand that there is a joy and there isn't a joy, but there is a seriousness to this as well. Again, this is not a class on marriage, so you know, we won't chase all the things that we could say about this, but part of it is because this is an image of Christ in the church, and God takes his images very seriously. Remember, he said, don't make images, live with the images I've given you. Don't literally tamper with the images of ultimate reality that God has given us. And the other thing is we need to make sure we get in our minds, hearts and minds very clearly right now the truth of this, so that when God forbid, if God forbid, this comes up in our own families, kids, grandkids, extended family, brothers, sisters, whatever, we have the courage to hold the line. Because sin spreads. Yes, sir?
One thing I thought about is that the image that you say is Christ is, mm-hmm. We're supposed to behave like Christ. Well,
right.
If a Christian falls away, we divorce Christ. I'm using like Romans 7:4 as a parallel.
Yeah.
And God's attitude is he wants us to be reconciled back to him. He doesn't say, well, we can just remain apart. I mean, that would be a sin that we would be lost if that's the case. He wants us reconciled, so shouldn't that principle apply to 1 Corinthians 7:11, that remain or marry to be reconciled. It's like,
oh, agree,
he's
yeah.
not giving you a like a choice where you can just remain unmarried.
Right.
The goal is to try to get back.
Right.
And if not, then you have to wait until that person either comes back or dies.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is, and again, you know, putting we become very legalistic about this because we don't want to live in unhappy marriages or, you know, realize I married the wrong person. I think about all the euphemisms we use to justify our desire to get out of things. And part of in the larger context of this passage, where we're not being legalists about it, is I owe that person, you know, help with their sexual temptations. And I cannot do that. If I've, you know, robbed them, and again, I lead them, they're going to have to follow the law of the Lord on this too, and I have robbed them. I have robbed them. I put a stumbling block on the road to heaven in their way. And, you know, and so that's the thing. It's just not about me. You know, there's a fundamental truth that Jesus taught that we just really like to hear, and it's, you know, the one that would, you know, find their life must lose it. You know, you have to die to self to be a Christian. You just have to die to self and quit worrying about whether you're happy or not. You have to learn to do what's right because it's right because God said so. And the irony is when you do that, you'll begin to find what's real joy and not superficial shallow happiness in time. But we have to learn that our job is to do what's right because God says this is right. Jesus did not come to please himself. He came to live a very challenging life, put aside his own will, and say, let the Father's will be done. And if he hadn't done that, you and I would still be lost. This world is not the place where our happiness is the highest goal in God's plan. Our job is to become the people God called us and created us to be, so that when the new heavens and new earth comes, when eternity comes, we are prepared to be apt citizens of the paradise where joy knows no end. And all tears are wiped away. But all tears are not wiped away here, folks. That's still yet to come. And so we have to get on with losing ourselves in sacrificial service to the will of God. And literally, you're not walking in the steps of Jesus until you're doing that. Hard truths. All right. Now the room is very quiet and very solid. But we need to be clear on this, because this matters, because this is perhaps one of the areas in which, you know, most of us, of all of us, will be tempted at some point. This is an area which will be tempted, not personally in our own marriages, will be tempted because, again, of what family members do. We'll be tempted to waffle, to compromise, to whitewash, because it's hard. But even when Jesus first spoke the truth, the disciples said, man, this is hard to hear. It is. Yes, ma'am.
A hard marriage helps a Christian grow if you deal with it.
Because you start dying yourself. Right, because you start dying to self. I mean, and that's the thing, is I mean, at the end of the day, ironically, is our, you know, culture right now is debating, you know, childlessness, and it's a celebrated thing, it's a lifestyle choice, because you're, you know, Time Magazine ran that awful cover in 2013, I think it was, you know, basically celebrating, you know, basically the couple could do whatever they want because they're free of kids. And listen, you know, that there are a lot that go into a couple's decisions to have or not have kids. You know, I'm not going to get into that, but the fundamental idea is, you know, the fundamental idea from selfish motives, you know, that it's a good thing to do that. It's just, you know, so we'll have, you know, the dink, the double income, no kid lifestyle. There's a level of selfishness. If that's right, you know, marriage and family is the first place that God gives us to learn to die to self, because you don't survive in marriage and you don't survive it as a parent if you don't do that. So, all right. What else to say real quick about this? I almost forgot. So verse 12 and following, verses 12 through 16. So to the rest I say, and I not the Lord. What he means by that is not that this is opinion now. He said clearly what he was his opinion earlier. What he means now is Jesus didn't speak directly to this particular situation, but can Paul speak with the authority of Christ as an apostle? The correct answer is yes. So this does not mean this is just my opinion. What it means is Jesus didn't talk about this exact scenario. But remember, Jesus lived in Palestine in a Jewish scenario. Where is Paul?
Gentile.
Among the Gentiles, and their marriage culture, their marriage rule, very different. And so Jesus didn't have to speak to this scenario as such, or in quite the way that Paul's now recognizing the Corinthians may have to deal with some stuff here in the Greco-Roman culture. And to the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. Because what's the basic principle? Don't divorce. And if any woman has a husband who's an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. Stop right there. So what's the scenario Paul's envisioning? What Paul's envisioning is, and again, it's going to hit a little bit different in the Greco-Roman world than it will in the Jewish culture, which at least has its ethnicity still in place, even if one spouse becomes a Christian and one doesn't. But in the Greco-Roman world, which is much more what we might call today diverse, and so forth, Christians might actually wonder, okay, I became a Christian, my spouse did, because remember, what's the scenario here? You got people who are already married, Paul comes to town and says, hey, let me tell you about Jesus. Somebody decides to obey the gospel, their spouse doesn't. Now what do you got? You got a mixed marriage religiously, and the Christian spouse may be wondering, why would they especially start to wonder about this? Well, certainly just practicalities. You know, my spouse still goes to the temple, what do I do about that? Rodney Paul's about to talk about that. What do you do when your spouse keeps eating, you know, idol meat and going to, you know, or anybody you know goes to the idol temple and eats meat? What will you do with that? But beyond that, new Christian starts reading the only Bible they've got at that time, which is the Old Testament. And what do they see in the Old Testament about this issue of intermarriage? First of all, the law is emphatic, don't do it. And what kind of stories do you find in Ezra and Nehemiah? Well, not just kill, but
get out of,
bust up the marriage. Bust up the marriage. And if you understand that background, now you understand why Paul says actually what he's about to say in these verses. That for them, reading the only Bible they've got in their laps at this point, that's why they're getting letters from Paul still, and that's how we got the New Testament. Paul and the other apostles writing letters about these things. But when you got sitting in your lap right now is the old law, which both explicitly says don't intermarry with, you know, Jews shouldn't intermarry Canaanites, and examples of when that's happened in the marriage. Get out of it. And so Paul says, no. Now, under the covenant of Christ, if your spouse is contently, in other words, your spouse doesn't want to divorce you because you became a Christian, then what should you do? Stay in the marriage. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife. The unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. This causes confusion. Here's what you understand. This is Old Testament idiom. In Leviticus, Deuteronomy, some of the very specific laws. Holiness doesn't mean necessarily saved. Holiness just means not making you unclean. Or you making them, or potentially, go back a step. In the Old Testament, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, if something was unclean, did it make clean things unclean, or did the clean thing make an unclean thing clean? Which way did it flow?
It made it unclean.
Yeah. And the old law, the uncleanness spread. And so what Paul is saying is, no, now again, you've been reading your Old Testament. That's not how this works anymore. You can make them holy. It doesn't mean they're saved. It just means you have to bust up the marriage is what Paul is saying. It's not going to taint you. And that's why he chooses not saved, but unclean is his word. He's talking about kind of what we would call ceremonial distinctions now. You're not tainted because of them. And in fact, you can actually sanctify the marriage. It doesn't mean make it salvific, but it means make it the way God wants because you're doing what you're supposed to be doing by staying in the marriage. And by the same token, keeping your family together for the sake of your kids doesn't mean they're going to be saved automatically. It just means, because here's the thing, in the old law, in the Old Testament, holy doesn't necessarily mean saved, because things could be holy. Things can be clean and unclean. If a pot became unclean, what were you supposed to do with it? If it was made of clay or earthenware, what were you supposed to do with it? Break it. Kill that pot. No, anyways, you get the idea. So that's all Paul is talking about. He's talking about in the Old Testament idiom, you don't have to do what you read about in the Old Testament in these situations. It doesn't mean that you're going to save your spouse or your kids automatically. What it means is that the contagion flows a different way right now. And this is his whole point. Verse 16, for how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? How do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? By your living holy, and in a sense making the marriage holy by holding its integrity together, you might actually accomplish their salvation. But if what he meant when he says it's going to make it holy means just automatically saved, then he doesn't have to write what he says in verse 16. Think about it. Make sense? Then you wouldn't have to say if or who knows, or, you know, it's not a question then. The holiness just simply means it's sanctified before God. It's not illegitimate like in the Old Testament it would have been. No, you sanctify the marriage because you actually know what marriage is better than they do, and you know better what God wants in this, and you know how to live it, and for your part, that's what you're going to do. Verse 15, but if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. Ah, so now I can get out of jail free. Now I can, no, what's Paul saying is, again, in the context here, Are you going to leave the marriage if you're married to an unbeliever? No. But what about an unbeliever who doesn't know God, doesn't fear God, doesn't care about what God says, doesn't believe in this hokey religion you just bought into from this little, you know, huckster Paul who just came walking into town, who causes trouble everywhere he goes? You know, I can't believe you bought that internet fad. I can't believe you fell for it. And so your spouse sits there and says, I'm not doing this. This is actually unfair. Especially wives could very easily be in this, because in the Greco-Roman culture, wives were expected to have their husband's religion. And so your husband sits there and says, we need to go to the idol temple because it's a feast day, or because my business partner invited me, or because a family, you know, whatever. So we need to go to the temple of Jupiter there, and we need to do what we need to do. And the wife as a Christian now says, I can't do that. And the husband says, well, if you can't do that, then you're done. We're done. I can't deal with that. I need a political wife. I need somebody who's going to hold up her end of the image. And so he divorces that Christian woman. What's Paul saying? That's the scenario in the context that Paul's envisioning. Your unbelieving spouse doesn't know about God, or if they do, they don't care about God. They don't care about this, this no divorce principle. And so they leave. Now, as a Christian, what should you do? Having just been told, don't divorce. Don't separate. Don't do this. Now what do you do as a Christian? And that's what Paul means in the context. And he says, not under bondage or not, you don't have to. You don't have to basically say, oh, God said don't divorce, so I'm going to go and force myself on my spouse that does not want me anymore, my unbelieving spouse. I'm going to keep forcing myself on them and so forth. You're not under bondage in the sense of you have to enforce your spouse to live in the marriage that they themselves are trying to walk out on. You are not under bondage in the sense of God holds you accountable for fulfilling sexual needs and honoring the marriage vow. Does that make sense? For God has called us to peace. What's going to happen? What's going to happen if you try to force yourself on somebody who doesn't want you anymore? What's going to happen?
It's not going to end well.
It's not going to be peaceful. That's the
go to jail.
Yeah, now they call you out. But yeah, that's exactly right. Get the cops called on you and the domestic, stalking or some sort of charge. That's exactly right. And so that's what Paul is trying to alleviate the conscience of the Christian who, having heard all this, says, they left, but I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to not do what God said. So I've got to force myself. I got to stay in the marriage. And Paul says, no. But does that mean you have the right to remarriage? Well, notice in the verse, Paul says nothing about remarriage, which means we don't get to extrapolate or assume. What has Paul already said about remarriage when divorce happens?
Reconcile
or remain. There is no remarriage in this verse. Paul is simply talking to a Christian spouse who has an unbelieving spouse divorced them. What do you do? And Paul says you do not have to force yourself on somebody who does not want you, lest you be guilty of breaking what God has said. Does that make sense? There is no remarriage in this verse or in this context. He is simply giving comfort to conscience of the sincere Christian who just wants to do what God says. And again, in a situation where in marriage, unlike so many other life choices, part of whether or not I can do what I'm told to do depends upon the other person staying in the marriage, accepting me, and so forth. I cannot completely obey this without my spouse's participation. That's the reality about the marriage situation. I can try to do it, and I can do everything right on my end and still wind up in a bad spot because the other person chose not to do what God says. Yeah, Randy.
So I'm going to keep this brief because I know you're...
Chapter 8.
So in that event, when a person is trying to do what's right and the spouse leaves, given the example you did in this culture, it would be likely he would divorce that wife and remarry, commit adultery, and go on with his life with his new political arm around, or his new wife there. I believe that would release her at that point because he has now gone off and committed adultery, which would destroy the marriage relationship between those two.
Sure, that's one possibility. I mean, there's a lot to talk about.
There is. And
there's a lot to talk about.
But,
there.
Paul, it's interesting that he stops early. He doesn't get any further into that. But if the man really did, said, listen, because what you're doing with this Christianity, I'm out of here,
right,
and goes and remarries,
right,
that certainly would start fitting the context, but it's kind of a strange thing because you're getting divorced because of your faithfulness to God.
Well, and that goes back to, now we're back to 1 Peter, which is basically, you entrust your soul to a faithful Creator in doing what's right.
Right.
That doing what's right may well, blessed are you when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake.
Right.
God, John's gospel, that the world hated you, just know they hated me first. I mean, this is the lot of the Christian, and we've just gotten so used to not having to deal with this in a relatively comfortable culture. culture, but, you know, I think most of us see the handwriting on the wall that the world is changing, you know, and the price of holding the line on these things is going to get us back to being called haters of mankind pretty quick here in the coming years and decades.
I mean, that's exactly what I was going to mention, okay. That when you look back at the 70s and 80s, marriage looks so, according to God's word.
But we still think it was now a man and a woman. It's,
you know,
yeah.
And families stayed intact under the same roof. I don't care what the living conditions were. We could say, I remember when we didn't have this, I didn't have that, but we stayed together.
Right.
And our parents made that happen. Today, it's, oh, well, I'm out of here.
Well, and part of it too, Elise, is back in those days, most of us who were around then, you know, we had parents and or grandparents who did stick it out. And so we actually had role models in that. Whereas by this point in the culture's dissolution, younger people, they have no role models in sticking it out. What they have role models of is if it's not working, leave. You know, now that, you know, well, you know, 50% of all marriages are in divorce. So that's the thing, is, you know, what our culture has done is exhausted all the fumes, all the leftovers of an intact culture on some of these things, or relatively. And I mean, it was never eaten out there, folks. But yeah, now you know, the younger generation doesn't know a world when this has been normal. Let me get Eric real quick, and then we got to keep moving.
So I'm talking about the parenthetical in 12, mm-hmm. I, not the Lord,
yeah.
Right? So I guess my question is, how much heavy lifting is that doing in this section? And then what does that mean to us as far as like how we understand this section?
Depending on what you mean by heavy lifting, I don't think it really does. I think it's just want to make very clear that, you know, in contrast to verse 10's first parenthetical, not I, but the Lord, mm-hmm. you know, that basically in verses 10 and 11, he sees himself as doing nothing but teaching exactly what Jesus taught in the Gospels in his own words, which is basically don't divorce. Because even we forget, in Mark's account and Luke's account, the exceptions, such as they are, that we always focus on, you know, it's even more subscribed in the Matthew version that we typically talk about. And if you haven't done that, you might go back then. You might read how Mark and Luke record Jesus' teaching on this, because Mark and Luke did not spend nearly as much effort, you know, focusing on the disciples, and the Pharisees, They just very much focused on Jesus saying, here's the basic principle, bottom line, don't worry about loopholes, don't look for exceptions. The basic principle is this. And so that's what all that he's, I think, what Paul's saying there. And he just wants to make very clear again that by the time he gets to verse 12, that, you know, unlike when he said opinion earlier, you know, this is my opinion earlier, you know, that this is now him just dealing with a scenario and a potential exception that Jesus did not talk about. Jesus did not talk about this scenario when he was on earth. But I'm going to go ahead and speak about this now. But this is not opinion. This is law of the Lord. But it's just Jesus, I'm repeating what Jesus said. Now I'm going to apply it, verse 12, in a way that Jesus didn't bother to apply it while he was here.
Okay. So it's not, this isn't a command from God, this is my advice. It's more, I'm an apostle and I have been given the authority to right. say such things, even though the Lord hasn't specifically said so.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah. You know, this is him now doing his apostle thing, and basically, you know, Jesus said, I have many more things to tell you, but you can't bear them now. Well, the time has come to bear them. And so Paul is making his own inspired applications of what the Lord said.
Which is kind of how he wraps up this chapter with, I too believe that I have the Spirit.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. In fact, with that, you know, wonderful little segue. what am I trying to get to here? So bottom line, let's, you know, now for sake of time, verse 39. So bottom line, a wife is bound to her husband as long as she is happy. No.
Until she kills him.
That's right. And David will have one of his beloved true crime podcasts. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. Yet in my judgment, again, that's where he's saying now again, my judgment, my opinion, she's better to remain as she is, and why would he say that? Well, we formally said earlier, you know, all this is what we talked about very quickly there. Now that you know the end is near, and especially if you're an old, if you're a widow or widower, chances are you're of a certain age, and so especially, even if the end of the world's not necessarily going to happen in your life, your end is pretty near, and Paul's whole point is, again, what's best for the kingdom? If you can, you know, especially as your, you know, your testosterone or your estrogen reigns, you know, if you don't have that urge and that desire quite as much anymore, and you can stay focused on the Lord in your you know, last years, that's what it's all about for Paul. I in whatever condition each was called to remain with God. I just went to the wrong line. I mean, in my judgment, she's happier if she remains as she is, and I think that I too have the Spirit of God. In other words, I'm channeling the Lord's values. I'm not giving this as a command, but in the larger value system of which the Lord wants us to think as Christians, I think this is what the Lord would want. One last little thing there, verse 39. Again, easy to miss. If her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only the Lord. Yeah. What does that seem to be saying?
Only marry a believer.
Equally yoked. You would have equal push to serve the Lord.
Yeah. So that earlier scenario that we were just talking about, what happens if my unbelieving spouse walks out the door? Here comes Paul saying, okay, you're actually free to make the choice now? Legitimately? What choice should you make when you actually have the choice?
Only the Lord.
Only the Lord. And we need to talk to our young people about this too, gang. We need to talk to our young people about this. We need to be much more adamantly reminding our young people they need to be looking to fellow Christians for spouses. Not people of high incoming potential, not people you meet at college, they get along with really well. They might be really great people, that's great. But at the end of the day, listen to Paul here, what's the highest value, what's the highest point? What's the most important principle in my decision-making chart?
That person will be serving the Lord.
That's right. How can I best serve the Lord with the life I have been given? And there it is there before Paul's out of this chapter. You're actually free to make the choice. What should be, you know, first thing you're looking for in a potential spouse?
Someone who's going to help me get that.
Only the Lord. Yes, ma'am.
I'm not sure where it's found, but it talks about these scenarios that if a spouse leaves their wife or husband unscripturally, and that person remains unmarried that was left. And so the other one that left unscripturally,
okay.
They are out there, mm-hmm. So they put the other person in a bind of, mm-hmm. you know, marrying, so they die.
Yeah.
Or even if they left unscripturally and the other person dies, it releases that person.
Yeah, I mean, that's his whole point here. Death releases whatever marital, even in God's eyes, whatever marital, you know, even if there's a bunch of sin, but in God's eyes, death ends that commitment.
Even if it was done unscripturally, death levels it.
Yeah, death, you know, releases. I think that's what he's teaching. I think Romans 7, you know, implies that as well.
Yeah.
Romans 7 kicks in on that. But yeah, this is not a class on divorce and remarriage, and we could kick around all sorts of crazy scenarios, and the elders can tell you about some crazy scenarios and very difficult, challenging scenarios. But so let's get back to Corinthians and kind of stay on the so chapter 8, switching gears. Now Paul deals with another major issue, which is the temptation to cultural compromise. And he deals with this, you know, the issue is, what do you do with foods that are sacrificed to idols? So let's just start by understanding the cultural background here a little bit. There was no Aldi, Walmart, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, or wherever your preferred shopping location is. I grew up with Publix, where shopping is a pleasure. Still can't get that jingle out of my head after decades. By the way, Publix is a great chain. It's not HEB. HEB really is the best. But Publix isn't bad. Publix is like the Florida HEB, and it expires in the HEB. They just don't know. But anyways, so in that world, where did most meat come from? This is very foreign to us, but in that world, most meat came from the leftovers from pagan temples' sacrifices. It was a side business. Like, it was another revenue stream, we'd say today, if you, you know, your MBA parlance. You know, it was a, you know, it was another revenue stream for the temple. They had literally, they were overflowing with meat, you know. And so, you know, some pagan would do, you know, if it was a holiday or some pagan comes there and wants a sacrifice, whatever it is, you know, and you kill this animal, and the priest would get their cut, and, you know, and often, you know, this is part of the temptation that the Christian would have to deal with. A lot of times, somebody might even, you know, have a sacrifice at the idol's temple, invite his friends, family members to come along and celebrate with him at the temple. There were dining rooms at these ancient temples. And so you could then actually eat some of the sacrificial meat right then and there while you were there in the idol's temple in one of these dining rooms. And then, you know, but ultimately still, the bottom line is the temple had a bunch of leftover meat. So what would they do with it? They would take it out to the market, the shambles there, the agora, and it would be sold. And so the vast, not all, but the vast majority of meat that you just go to the market to buy your meat, the vast majority of the meat you're going to get is therefore most likely, highly likely to have been sacrificed to an idol. And the Corinthian Christians are saying, okay, I've got a couple of questions. Number one, can I eat meat that's been sacrificed to an idol? And related to that, can I eat in the idol's temple itself when I've been invited? Can I go? You know, and why might I sit there and think that it's okay to go to the idol's temple and eat there? Because what they know now is that are idols anything? Are these really gods?
There's only one true God.
Is there Jupiter out there stalking you with his lightning bolts? No. Is Aphrodite really helping you to improve your love life? No. And so on and so forth. And so as a Christian, you know there was one true God. And so your temptation is to sit there and say, if there's nothing behind this, what's the big deal with eating meat in an idol's temple? The problem with that is you know that, but who doesn't?
Those who are trying.
Two potential audiences. The weak Christian who has not matured to the point that, you know, just like when somebody's just baptized, they actually understand a whole lot of things about instrumental music or about, you know, women's roles and why women can't preach. I mean, they understand a whole lot of the downstream that they might have assumed from the world, from the culture. Do they know all that? No. Would a new Christian necessarily get the full implications of monotheism when you grew up in a polytheistic culture? Yeah. No, of course not. We take it for granted now because Christianity has so thoroughly crushed in the West polytheism that it's our default. It was not their default. Monotheism was a huge mind bender. What does it really mean that there's only one God? And it would take a while for new Christians in that culture to get their minds around the fact that there's nothing behind this. And so you've got that. You've got, you know, new Christians, weak Christians who don't understand it. And so when they see you in the idol's temple eating, what are they going to assume? That you can worship God and the idol. And okay, so that's one issue. And then the other audience is?
Unbelievers.
Yeah, your pagan friends and neighbors, the guy who invited you to this in the first place. And what's he going to assume you're okay with?
Participating.
What's he going to assume you're okay with when you wear a rainbow lanyard in June?
You're okay with his way of thinking.
This is how the rubber meets the road today. We have to be very careful as Christians at what we participate in. If we say, I said, the rainbow is God's and I'm taking it back. I'm going to do it in June especially because I don't want to get trouble with HR. But it's God's rainbow and I'm taking it back. The problem is, if you do that in June, what's it going to look like? I'm participating. This is the fundamental dynamic, and by the way, I've jumped from then to now, but this is the fundamental dynamic Christians have to wrestle with. Not what do I know in my head about this, the rainbow belongs to God, or it's all meat, it's just meat, God made it, you know, it should be received with thanksgiving, you know, just all of that. It's just meat, and there is no other God out there that I'm really worshiping and doing this. I'm just hungry and I want to eat. I just don't want to make it awkward when I skip the office party at the idol's temple. And Paul says, you may have the knowledge, but you have to be aware of how it looks to people who don't have that knowledge. That's the bottom line of chapters 8 through 10.
All liberty and law love.
That's it. And so understanding that, chapter 8, go back to the, you know, before he deals with the actual issue, he starts with the principle. And we kind of walk through the dynamic. Look at, here's the basic principle, chapter 8, first paragraph, verses 1 through 3. Now concerning foods offered to idols. You don't actually talk about that until verse 4. But what it gives here is the principle that you have to weigh this all in. We know that all of us possess knowledge. Yes, Christians know better. But this knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. knowing things without weighing them in love, how it's going to affect other people, is arrogance. Well, they should know better. Nobody should judge me. No, no. What Paul's going to do, because time's going to catch us, what Paul's going to do in chapter 9, he's going to use himself as an example of, I have knowledge. I have a right to eat of the gospel. I have a right to be paid for what I do. I do not take that. He's going to use a crucial word, a very American word in chapter 9 several times. It's the word, I have a right. Very American word to this day. I have my, why should I go forego my rights because you're ignorant? That's the language of pride, not the language of love. The fundamental issue, Paul says, is not what do we know, but how do we use what we know in a way that lovingly builds others up, that does not cause them to stumble and needlessly do things that they believe are wrong, which is still sin for them, because if they do something that, this is another passage, this is Romans chapter 14, but one of the things that Paul teaches is basically, even if something is actually right, it's okay, but you do it believing it's wrong, it's still sin. Why?
Violation of conscience.
Violation of conscience, but what makes it wrong for you to do that?
Because you know better.
Because, well, because you don't know better. But
your heart.
Your heart. That's it. Because in my mind, if I'm doing what's wrong, what is that fundamentally still the spirit of? Force God.
Rebellion.
That's still rebellion. And so that's how doing even something that may be technically right becomes wrong for me. If I do it, believing it's wrong, but I saw you, stronger Christian, with your knowledge, doing it. I'm not convinced it's right yet, but since I saw one of the elders do it, since I saw the preacher do it, since I saw one of the pillars of the congregation do it, I'll go ahead and do it because Brother so-and-so must know what he's doing. I'm not convinced it's right, but I'm not following God from faith, I'm following
man.
So this is not just an issue here, this is an issue in other of Paul's writings as well. The fundamental issue of knowledge puffs up, and then frame it the way he frames it in chapter 9, insisting upon my rights at others' expense is pride. And we don't live by pride, we live by faith and love. It's not about what's good for me, it's about what's good for you. And so now you can understand what Paul's going to say. You know, again, when he gets to one of the punchline points, when he kind of, verse 13, therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I know there is no idol, and so I know it's just me too, because I'm the one who told you that. I'm the apostle who told you that. But if food makes my brother stumble, what does Paul say, verse 13? Welcome to Salada for lunch. I'll never eat meat again. Because it's not worth your soul because of my knowledge and rights. And that is the segue into chapter 9. Chapter which are always in the wrong places. If you don't believe that yet, you're going to someday. Because chapter 9, it is his illustrating something that he did give up a right to for the sake of others. His right to be, and the Corinthian context, now we know Paul took money from other congregations. It wasn't an absolute, I'll never take money for preaching. But in the Corinthian context, he knew it was not wise for them because Paul, reading between the lines, what Paul really understood about Corinth, when you read all of 1 Corinthians, when you read 2 Corinthians, what Paul understood about them, because they were so prone to pride and boasting, is if he took money from them, they would see themselves as superior to him. And really, he's dependent upon them and make them less likely to listen to him without the financial connection there. But Paul took money. You know, what does he say to the Philippians? Thanks for the gift, again. You know, Paul definitely made right to eat of the gospel. But in the Corinthian context, he recognized that if he accepted that right with the Corinthians, where's the Sunday contribution today? You know, I've been preaching to you all week. Where's my paycheck? With their spiritual issues, it would cause them to get the wrong idea about apostles. And that's a huge problem from chapter 4 all the way into 2 Corinthians 10 through 13. That is a huge problem the Corinthians had. And so Paul recognizes that out of love for them, not knowledge. Knowledge says I have a right to be paid by these guys. But out of love for them, Paul says, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to insist upon my right. Chapter 10, 1 through 13. We know this section, but we don't get what he's doing in context. What he begins to do in context, he begins to remind them that pride goes before a fall. The pride of knowledge. Because ironically, Israel died in the wilderness, he said. Israel, who knew what you know about idols, that's why he chooses the golden calf episode.
Israel, who knew what you knew about idols, but what did Israel wind up doing because they played too close to the line? The golden calf. And they died in the wilderness, you know, and then the larger, you know, spirit of their rebellion. They died. And so the problem, Paul says, is also, basically, when you are so busy in your pride and your arrogance, pushing the lines of what my knowledge allows me to do, what are you going to get too close to? If that's your framework for making your spiritual decisions, what is that eventually going to get you too close to? The world. And what's going to happen eventually?
You're going to get burned.
You're going to get burned. Look at Israel, Paul said. They had every advantage you have, and you know, you were baptized, they were baptized. I mean, just, you know, that's his whole point in this passage. They were like you. They had knowledge. They had a relationship with God. They stayed too close to the world, and they fell into idolatry. So don't you think you're going to avoid idolatry. You want to push your knowledge to the limit. And there's a warning that we need to teach our young people as well. It's not about what's right and wrong, it's about what's wise and what's foolish. What draws us closer to God or what brings us closer to the world. And that's why I picked that illustration where he does in this passage. Because then in verse 14, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. Quit asking how close to the line can I get in this area. All right, bell rang, and we have two Sundays left.
Half the book to go.
And half the book to go.